System on RadioArea.com.
Now our next speaker will be speaking on the subject of community activism. He's a friend and colleague of the great late John Tyndall. He's been an active nationalist since 1974. He stood as a candidate for both the National Front and the British National Party, and over the years he's been instrumental for setting up three branches, nationalist branches. He's also a founding member of Western Spring, which is one of the most popular websites in Britain, for which he is currently editor and operations director. Please put your hands together, give a very warm welcome to speak on community action, Max Musson.
Thank you very much, Jez. It's a great pleasure to be here and to speak to so many people. And as an earlier speaker said, it shows that nationalism is on the turn, because the numbers that I see at meetings are rising as well. And so I think that we can take some heart from that and look forward to a very good future for our people. At the moment, though, nationalism is going through a period of change, and that period of change means that there's a certain amount of uncertainty. Some people find that uncertainty is demotivating and demoralising, and they feel frustrated that the future isn't as clear-cut as they would perhaps like it to be. But periods of change are necessary, and it's certainly necessary that, that nationalism goes through a period of change today. We've had a number of people have mentioned the Batley and Spen election, and all I really want to say about the Batley and Spen election is that what happened there was the consequence of the fact that none of the nationalist candidates that took part in that election have a constituency in Batley and Spen. By constituency, I don't mean a constituency in the sense of a parliamentary constituency. I mean a constituency in the sense of a community that actually supports them. Virtually all of the candidates that took part in the Batley and Spen election were people who were parachuted in from outside, who'd got no local knowledge, who had never ever campaigned in Batley and Spen previously, and so therefore there was nothing to support them. And electoral success in will come from three things. Electoral success can come from having the wholehearted support of the mass media behind you, and the mass media can create a bandwagon effect behind an individual who is otherwise presentable and otherwise a good quality candidate. And just the support of the mass media can carry a candidate to electoral victory. But we don't have the support of the mass media, and as nationalists, we are never going to have it. And anybody who is here today who hopes that the mass media in this country is one day going to suddenly discover what lovely people we are and decide to support us in the elections, those people are wishing for something that's never going to come, that's never going to happen. The second thing that we need, that you would need to have in order to win an election, is a massive fund of money behind you so that you could buy the positive media coverage that's needed, and you could buy the activists and recruit people to come in and employ them to campaign on your behalf in order to make a massive sort of campaign, and that would require somebody with very deep pockets, the sort of people who have tended to support UKIP in recent times and who have shown themselves to be fair weather friends, because now that the Brexit vote has gone through, the big sponsors of UKIP seem to be deserting them and going back to the Conservatives. But we are unlikely to have somebody, we are unlikely to have a multi-millionaire or a billionaire come to us and say, yeah, I'll write you a big cheque so that you can have a massive election campaign so that you can win this local election. Because by their very nature, billionaires are people who are making lots of money out of the status quo. And they don't want to invest in something that's going to bring about an uncertain future. They want things to stay just as they are. And so that's where they put their money, behind organisations that want things to stay just as they are. The third thing that you need to have if you're going to win an election is that you need to have a very militant and organised body of people in the area in the ward or the constituency where you're standing. And this is what I meant by having a constituency. You need to have a group of people, a sizable number of people who are absolutely your fanatical supporters, who will work day and night, who will invest every ounce of energy and every ounce of spare money they've got into enabling you to win that campaign. That's what you're going to need. And the sad fact is that none of the nationalist parties that took part in the Batley and Spain election had actually bothered to grow such a body of people. And that's the kind of thing that I'm going to talk to you about today. One of the problems with nationalism in the past is that we have, metaphorically speaking, behaved like 18th century soldiers. We've lined ourselves up with our red tunics on so that everybody can see us, and we've had our battle standards, our big flags that we've waved, and in serried ranks we've marched down the high street into a withering hail of denigration and smears that have been fired at us by the mass media, and we've got us had ourselves shot to pieces. And warfare on the battlefield is very, very similar to warfare in the electoral field. And the one thing that you don't do if your forces are small in number is have everybody dress up in red tunics and wave flags and go marching into the face of the enemy's guns. What you do is you employ guerrilla tactics, so that you employ subterfuge, so that you employ camouflage, so that you can creep up on the enemy, so that you can occupy the key strategic positions before you engage the enemy, and you engage the enemy at a time which is not of the enemy's making, but which is the time which is the most inconvenient for the enemy, at a time when you can do the most damage and have the greatest chance of success. So what we need to do is we need to change the mindset of nationalists, because for too long we've had, as Julie said, we've had small groups of people, perhaps 10 people, perhaps 5 people, meeting in an upstairs room of a pub, deciding they're going to launch a new political party, and within the month they've identified a ward somewhere in some obscure part of the country where they've never been before, where they have no constituency, where they have never ever campaigned before, and they go marching down the high street with their red tunics on, waving their battle standards, and then they wonder why they get shot to pieces. And we've got to change that mindset and change it quite dramatically. Part of the problem with nationalism as well is that we have no organised community. If you look at ethnic minorities automatically fall into a situation where they have an organised community around their ethnic group. And we don't have that amongst white people, because we've been the ethnic majority for so long, and this country's never been conquered. We've never been subdued and subjected to slavery and oppression by a foreign oppressor for so long that any concept of what it would be like to be a conquered people has escaped us. But slowly, bit by bit, insidiously, over the last few decades, we've come to realise what it's like to be a subdued and a conquered people, because that's very, very slowly what we're becoming. And nationalists have not liked to admit that that's the case. Nationalists have tended to deny what has become a reality. And so because they deny what is a reality, they continue to operate in a way that would have been successful if Britain had not been in the situation that we're in. If we were in a situation where the socio-political climate in which we operate was one in which, where the underlying values of nationalism were valued, where the principles of nationalism were accepted as commonplace, then it would be different. But we're not. We're living in a multicultural society where political correctness reigns, where cultural Marxism reigns, and we've got to adopt the tactics that make you successful in a multicultural society. If we carry on employing the tactics that make you successful in a monoracial society, we'll continue to fail. We've got to adopt the tactics that make you successful in a multiracial society and a multicultural society. If we look at ethnic minorities, what we see is that they live in organised communities. They don't all live in organised communities. Some of them live outside of their organised communities, and they suffer as a result of living outside the organised communities, and over a period of time they realise that what side their bread's buttered on, and so they then join in with the organised communities and they gravitate towards those organised communities. But they live in organised communities where there are where there is an ethnic council which looks after their affairs, which lobbies the government, where there are all sorts of ethnic organisations that have been created to support their community in a foreign environment, because a multiracial society is an environment that's foreign to everybody that's in it. It's foreign to the foreigners that come here, and it's foreign to the people who are the indigenous people of this country. And we've got to learn to live like foreigners in a foreign country. The ethnic minorities in this country live in self-identifying in-groups, and they practice an in-group preference in all of their things. And so what you find is that where a member of an ethnic minority becomes the manager of a supermarket in a particular area, it doesn't take long before there's an extremely large number of people who work in that supermarket, all belonging to that same ethnicity. Or if he becomes the proprietor or the manager of a taxi rank, it's not long before every taxi in that town is operated by somebody of the same ethnicity. And this is because of the in-group preference, which is something which comes naturally to people who are used to living in a foreign country, or used to living in a country where they are an oppressed people. They look after their own ethnic self-interest. And so what you'll find in ethnic minority areas is that there will be individual ownership of community infrastructure. They will own their own places of worship. They will buy pubs that are no longer used as pubs, and they'll convert them into mosques. Or they'll buy pubs that are no longer used as pubs, because there's so few people of British extraction still living in that area, and they will use those pubs as, they'll have a change of use passed by the local authority, and they will use them as community centres. What you'll find is that they engage in business proprietorship. And so instead of their people going and their first choice being to go and work for a multinational corporation that has a department or has some kind of a presence in their town, their natural inclination is to start their own business that their own people in that community can give preference to, and because their own people in their community give preference to them, that business flourishes. And so you see the proprietorship in ethnic minority parts of the major big cities, that there will be owner run and restaurants, there will be owner run franchises. So where there is a franchise chain that perhaps covers the rest of the country and which is corporately owned in most of the rest of the country, you'll find that the franchise outlets that exist in ethnic minority areas tend to be owned by franchisees who are members of that ethnic minority, who've clubbed together with their friends to raise the money to buy the franchise so that they own that place of business. They own the shops, they own the taxes. And when it comes to investments, whereas most white people, if they're saving for their pension, will put their money into a pension fund offered by a financial services organisation, or if they're saving for some indeterminate reason, whatever it happens to be, a lifetime a holiday of a lifetime to Australia or something, they'll put their money into an institutional savings account with a bank or through a unit trust company or something like that, or whatever it happens to be. You'll find that white people invest their money through institutional investment companies, whereas ethnic minorities, they tend to invest their money in property. They invest their money in property so that they own the infrastructure in the town and in the location where they live, because ownership confers control, and control equates with conquest. And the process of colonization that's taking place is a process of acquiring ownership, exercising control, and exerting conquest. The white population in this country is different. White population in this country is not organized, as I said earlier on. Conscious ethnic self-interest is discouraged amongst the white community. Our children go to school and they're taught to be all lovey-dovey and multiracial, and to regard everybody as being the same, and to not worry if all the people around them, and if the people that employ them and the people that control their lives are members of an ethnic minority. They're told not to worry about that, because we're all the same. If we if we're cut, we all bleed red blood, don't we? We don't seem to realise that if you cut a frog, it will bleed red blood as well. The frog's not related to us. And what you find is that there is very little ownership of the community infrastructure. Our places of worship aren't owned by our people. Our places of worship are owned by the Church of England or the Roman Catholic Church or some other institutional religious organisation that doesn't have our ethnic interests at heart. And so therefore, we as a people who exercise our own ethnic self-interest don't own our places of worship. Somebody else does. And so therefore, we don't have ownership, we don't have control, and therefore, that's a bad thing. Community centres in the towns where we live are not owned by us. The community centres are owned by the local authority. And the local authorities are composed of worthies who are appointed largely or elected as a result of their kowtowing to the existing power structure in this country, which is diametrically opposed to our ethnic self-interest. And so therefore, community centres are outside of our scope of control as well. And what we find is that businesses within white communities tend to be, to a far greater extent, corporate businesses where there is no local personal proprietorship on the part of anybody who's part of our community. And so we find that petrol stations are parts of petrol station chains, whereas they would have been an individually owned franchise had that same petrol station been in an ethnic minority area. We find there are chain stores, there are supermarkets and superstores, and even where the restaurants are there, all too often the restaurants aren't privately owned restaurants. Restaurants are parts of chains like Frankie and Benny's and TGI Fridays, and organisations where there is institutional control and where the people who control the institution, people who decide how that institution operates, are people who don't have our ethnic interests at heart. And so therefore, we're in a weakened position. And as I said before, when it comes to investing, we have institutional investments. So lack of ownership equates to lack of control, which equates to subordination. And so our population has become subordinate to the invader. And this is what we have to change. We've got to change the way in which we operate so that we benefit from the social dynamics that exist in a multicultural society. In a multicultural society, all of the ethnic groups are compelled by the social dynamics of such a society to exercise and express ethnic self-interest. They operate in group preference, and by operating in group preference and nothing else, they're able to enrich themselves at the expense of the host community. People very often say, oh, you know, the Asians are really, really good at running corner shops. Oh, they're really, really good at running taxi ranks. Oh, the Jews, they're really, really good at running department stores. Blah, 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 blah. But in reality, these people are no better at doing these things than we are. The only difference, the only thing that makes them successful, and massively successful in many cases, is the fact that they operate in group preference. If anybody wants to see how that works in a mechanical way, there's an article I've written on our website, which is called Paradise Island, the Parable. Read Paradise Island, the Parable, and you will understand the social dynamics that enables just mere ethnic preference to create massive wealth amongst ethnic minority populations. We're in denial, and we're not playing to our advantage in this multiracial society. And if we are to build a proper community, a cohesive community, if we're going to build a constituency, if we're going to build a stronghold that will support us and that will possibly enable us to get our people elected at some point in the future, then we've got to change the way that we work and the way that we live. We've got to change the way that we operate. We've got to look at the community infrastructure in the areas where we live. We've got to look at the housing and the ownership of that housing. We've got to look at schools, we've got to look at shops, restaurants, pubs, we've got to look at places of worship. We've got to look at the parish councils that exist. We've got to look at residence associations. We've got to look at clubs and societies, youth clubs, the scouts. And we've got to recognise these things as the strategic positions that we need to conquer if we're going to win the battle. Because unless we own and control these strategic high points in the field of battle in which we're engaged with the enemy, then we will never win the battle. And we've got to devise a plan wherever we live to enable people with our ethnic self-interest at heart to occupy, to gain control of and ownership of those things that form the community infrastructure, if we're going to have a hope of turning the tide and of winning the battle at the end of the day. So where do we start? Some people will say to me, I could never take part in any one of these community building exercises to create one of these militant enclaves that you talk about, because the area that I live in is X, Y, and Z, and I don't really want to move to some other part of the country. Well, you don't have to move to some other part of the country. All you need to do is to identify a community that has definable community boundaries. And so what you'll find is that a community that has a definable community boundary could be a village, but it doesn't have to be a village. It could be a suburb, or it could be a village that's been swallowed up by a conurbation. As long as it's got a centre, a community centre, a town centre, or a village centre that perhaps previously used to exist with a church and a pub and a restaurant and some shops, as long as it's got that, then you've got a definable community. And what you need to do is to have a look at where you live, or if you live in an area which, upon examination, you think is totally unsuitable for this, then look around you for the nearest place that looks like the right place to be. Get together with other people who are nationalists that you've known of old, people who have been members of parties that you've been members of before, and talk to them about this idea, and talk to them about moving to that area that is an ideal target place to go to. It doesn't have to be miles and miles away. It can be quite close. But if you can get a number of nationalists who are active people to go and settle in your target area, and you increase the density of people who are fanatical nationalists living in that area, then what you will do is you will change the dynamics of the community in that particular target area. And what you need to do is to take stock of the community infrastructure, the schools, the shops, the places of worship, the community centres, etc., that I've already listed before. You need to take stock of that community infrastructure and look at who is controlling them at the moment, whether those people are with us or whether those people are against us. And you need to gather together that initial small nucleus of people, and you need to be absolutely fanatical and ruthless in your determination that you are going to change forever the dynamics in that particular village. You are going to use whatever means are necessary, and hopefully it will only require you to use very modest means, but if necessary, you must decide you're going to use whatever means are necessary to change the dynamics of that community, to convert it into a fanatical enclave of people who are consciously white, people who want their community to remain white, and you must begin to organise those people, devise a plan, and start work. You must create within that community a self-identifying in-group from the people who are with us. And you can say, well, how do you actually do that? But one way of doing that, even if you don't know everybody that's there, is to work on the basis of self-interest. And if you were to create within a local community a business circle, a kind of small, a mini chamber of commerce, then you could go to a local businessman, and it could be the local butchers, and you could say, you could start buying your meat from that local butcher's, and you could arrange for everybody else that's part of your group to go and buy their meat from that butcher's, because the butcher, if nothing else, is an owner, business proprietor who is potentially part of the community that you're trying to build. And if you go to that person after a period of time when he's got to know you, etc., and you just said, it must be a bit of a struggle for you to operate a butcher's business in a small community like this, where you're in competition with the big supermarkets, and where you know that a large proportion of people that live in this area are going to be going off to Tesco's or Sainsbury's or whatever, and the temptation for them to buy their meat there is going to be quite strong, and yet you've managed to continue to maintain this business here in the town, and I think that's actually quite commendable and quite amazing. And what you'll find, if you ask that person about how they got started in their business and what they see as the key factor in the success, the continued longevity of their business. They'll tell you all sorts of things, but the and they'll start to talk to you about the things that they regard as being their key selling points. And their main key selling point is going to be quality over convenience, and quality over price. And so what you then need to do is just to say to that person that you admire what they've done, that you value quality and you value service, and that you feel it's a shame that large chain stores and that supermarkets etc. are taking their business, and you want to help him help him to prosper in the future. And you belong to a group which, in this mythical village, which I'll call Royston Vasey, you've created in this village the Royston Vasey Chamber of Commerce, and your mission is to make the owner-occupier proprietorships within your village as prosperous as you possibly can, and that you want to perhaps organise a special festival around his shop where you organise a special meat-based festival where you promote his shop, and part of the central part of the festival could be that somebody wins a 3 months supply of meat for free or something like this. And what you do is once you've collected some money together, you can go to him and you can say, well, look, how much meat would this buy at cost price? And so you then create a hamper of meat, and you can perhaps add some other products that the peripheral products that the butcher also sells as well. And then you organise a meat festival. It could be Meat Monday, or it could be any kind of thing like that, just so that you get lots of people from the local community to come and visit the butcher's shop. And it could be that the people who enter into the raffle to win this 3 month supply of meat have to have at least made one purchase from that butcher's shop to qualify to enter the competition. It could be that you approach somebody who runs a local hardware store, and you could say that it's amazing that he's been able to continue to run his business in the face of large chains like B&Q, etc. And you could organise, during the summertime in that particular village, you could organise a soapbox racing event where two members of the same family race a soapbox down a predetermined route through the village, but the materials that are used to make those soapbox carts, 75% of them have to be purchased from his shop in order for them to qualify for the competition, and the person who wins the race wins a fabulous set of tools, which again you arrange to buy from this guy at trade price so that you can make the gift that much more economically. There's all sorts of things like that you can do to help promote local businesses. You can, as a small village chamber of commerce, you can invite people to come from banks who can talk to them about preferential loan arrangements that could be made available to people in the village. There's all sorts of things that you can do. But that's the kind of thing that you need to do so that you increase the proprietorship and the local ownership of the infrastructure within that village. And you need to create a sense of consciousness, a sense of community consciousness, and a sense of white community consciousness. And the politics in all of this, the overt politics, you introduce very, very slowly in a very, very dilute form so that you sound people out, you find out who likes this idea, who is amenable to this idea, and you very slowly introduce the idea to them that they need to counter corporate ownership of the infrastructure in the village or wherever they live, that they need to exclude ethnic minorities, that they need to adopt an anti-colonial mindset, because what's happened over recent decades in their community is that their community has been colonised by globalism, by the large chains, and it's been colonised by people from outside our country that are creating their own ethnic enclaves and displacing our people. And you must develop within that group an in-group versus out-group mentality. And most important of all, rather than create a political party that's going to go marching up and down the high street waving flags and attracting the attention of our enemies, what we need to do is to just proceed in a very quiet way so that we don't face any organised opposition. And proceeding in a quiet way would involve the Royston Vasey Society that you create in order to do all of this to effectively operate as a Masonic organisation. So it's an organisation that doesn't ever trumpet its existence, that perhaps has two names, one which is the real name of the organisation and the hardcore of people who control it, and then you've got the marketing name, which is the marketing name that you present for the local businesses in the village or the town where you're hoping to build that community. And so you operate as a Masonic community because that is how ethnic minorities flourish in a multicultural society. And if we want our people to flourish, we've got to do what you have to do to flourish in a multicultural society. We can't carry on doing the things that used to be helpful in a monocultural society because we don't live in one any longer. We've got to start doing the things that make people successful in a multicultural society. And so, using the Royston Vasey analogy, we'll be creating a local shop, a local white shop for local white people. And you've got to make the people that are part of this feel like a select group. And you need to organise social functions where you invite those people and make them feel part of a group which has a common identity, which has common concern for each other. You've got to organise social functions and community functions. You've got to invite those people to your birthday parties. You've got to invite those people to your weddings. When if you have children that are born and you go through christenings or any other naming ceremonies, you've got to invite those people along so that they can celebrate with you the things that are part of your life, and so that they then invite you to those similar family events in their life, and you celebrate their family life, and you then start to become a community again, so that you start to feel like an extended family, because that's the way that ethnic minorities extend their influence and gain influence in a multicultural society. But as I said, you need to remain inconspicuous, because if you got to the point where you could get a nationalist candidate elected in your area, once that nationalist candidate is elected, what would happen then is that a great big red flag would be waved above that community, and the eye of Sauron would swivel round and focus on your community, and the authorities would do everything they possibly could to disrupt what you're doing in that community. There was a guy in America who managed to buy about a third of the houses in a village where the houses were very cheap. I can't remember what his name is off the top of my head. But it barely moved the people in, and he was marching up and down the street waving swastika flags. And it didn't even take weeks, a matter of weeks, before the authorities found some technicality by which they could remove him from the village and frustrate all of his plans. And so we can't do that. So how do we grow in political influence once we've established this militant group of people who are prepared to vote for us? How do we gain political influence without creating a big red flag that we're waving to attract the attention of the authorities? And the way to do that is through entryism, because this is what the ethnic minorities do. There isn't a Pakistani party in this country. There isn't a Jewish party in this country. There isn't a Sikh party in this country. There's the Labour Party and the Liberal Democratic Party and the Conservative Party. And what Asians do in the areas where they predominate is that they all join the dominant establishment political party in their area, and they make sure that one of their people is elected as the prospective candidate in any election in that area, and their people get elected as Conservatives, as members of the Labour Party, as members of the Liberal Democrats, as members of UKIP even. And that's what we've got to do. And we've got to get our people elected. And once elected, our people can pay lip service to the political party that's elected them. But they can employ policies, and they could introduce policies and support policies that actually help our people and make our people strong, make our people wealthy, and that serve the community of people that have elected them. In this country, as I said earlier on, cultural Marxism prevails, political correctness prevails, and cultural Marxism has prevailed as a result of what Marxists call the long march through the institutions, and they took something like 75 years over achieving the position that they're in today. Some people say that we don't have 75 years, but as we start to build consciously white communities, what will happen is that we will buy ourselves more time, because we will be creating permanent communities of people who will be breeding colonies who will ensure that white people continue into the future. And all that's required is that we continue to grow those white communities so that we increase in number, we increase in wealth, and we increase in influence to a point whereby we are able to turn the tables on the traitorous establishment that currently run our country. We need to build biologically, we need to build sociologically an organisation. We don't need a political movement at the moment. What we need is a social movement, and that social movement will give birth to a political movement at a later date when it's strong enough. And so we need to build in a way which is as insidious as the long march to the institutions that the cultural Marxists took. We need to build an organisation whose growth will be kind of like the growth of a cancer that is metastasizing and eventually growing out of control of the body that's trying to prevent it, and out of control of the antibodies that are trying to suppress it. We must become the virus that spreads through every cell. We must become the cancer that metastasizes so that we have communities of our people growing militant and strong all over the country. We have to build a nationalist counter-revolution. So we must be insidious. We mustn't be the redcoats that go marching down onto the field of battle, waving our battle standards with our bright scarlet bodices on, ready to be shot to pieces. We've got to resist going off at half cock. We've got to resist going at it bullet a gate. We've got to prepare for possibly a period of years before we'll be strong enough to drive through lots of the things that I've been talking about. But we've got to spend the time in preparation, otherwise we will fall flat on our face. We've got to play the long game. We've got to inch forward imperceptibly, because at the moment we're weak, and we've got to inch forward until we occupy those strategic positions and until we're in a position of strength. Inch forward imperceptibly. Now, what I've described to you today is one facet of a multifaceted plan that I advocate for the nationalist movement for the future. It's one facet, it's one piece of a jigsaw, and as I keep repeating to people, the movement which will eventually bring success to nationalism, a movement of national salvation, will be composed of several of these pieces of jigsaw that all click together to create the whole picture. And so what I can say to you today is that you don't have to wait for somebody to elect you, for somebody to give you the little copper and enamel badge on it saying councillor before you actually start to act like a councillor. You can even call yourself councillor. It's not against the law to call yourself a councillor. Pretend that the organisation that you've created is a religious organisation. Call yourself pastor or something like that, because that's what they do in America, isn't it? If you want to have a badge of importance, then just invent your own badge of importance. We don't have to rely upon the badge of importance that's given to us by the people who are trying to engineer our genocide. We should give ourselves our own badge of importance. We should decide when we start to campaign in the ethnic interests of our people. We don't wait for them to say, okay, yes, you've now been elected, you've now got our badge of approval, and within certain guidelines you're able to campaign in the ethnic interests of your people, but if you overstep the line too much, then we'll remove you. We don't want to wait for that. We need to build our own organisation, and we need to assume responsibility for ourselves. And the parts of the jigsaw that I've spoken about in the past roughly represent the things that I write about, which I call the six prerequisites. We need to have an organisation in this country that represents each one of those six prerequisites, and probably more. And we need to work over a period of years. It will probably take 10 years at the very least for us to build to a situation where we have those six prerequisites, where we have all of the things that are necessary to enable us to advance to revolution readiness condition one, which is the point at which we will be able to engineer a proto-revolutionary situation, and we'll be able to strike. And if we invest that time preparing for that occasion so that we have those resources behind us, and our people will be able to rise up. We'll be able to storm the citadels of their power. We're going to take back our country. Thank you.
Beating the invaders at their own game. Recolonising our own country. Max Masson. Now we have an extra speaker. He is a chartered accountant.
Ooh.
Ooh. He is an Oxford graduate.
That's right.
He's a retired army officer.
Hooray!
And he's a former National Front parliamentary candidate.
Yay!
Ian Bonvillo.
Thank you, Jez. Which one of those can I discard? I wasn't a professional army officer, but I was an army officer and TA officer for 17 years. Okay, let's do that. Well, I just want to speak for a short while to make some observations on what I've heard today. So I hope I've only got 10 minutes, because I don't think I could extend beyond that. Brexit. That was the outstanding seismic event.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Richard Edmonds was quite right in laying stress on that. But I want to draw your attention to the fact that Farage's victory, and it was Farage's victory, was based on simplicity.
Yes.
The repetitive message, take back control. How was he criticised? For being too simple. For not having a manifesto. For not going into all these fiddling details, which have had all the nationalist movements that come into being quarrelling with each other about how many angels could sit on the head of a pin. Keep it simple. The message is, love your own people.
Yes.
Yeah. There's no hatred in this. Love your country. And love your country, men and women.
Yes.
Yeah. No hatred for the people who you feel are not your country, men and women, in any natural sense, but just the fact that you prefer your own people.
Yes.
And if you pursue that, the simplicity of it, it's one. It's 17 plus million. Million votes. And they were all saying the same thing, which will now bring us to the point that if we're going to take it on from there and use those 17.25 million votes, are we going to try and parcel them out about amongst the people who'll be competing? UKIP, what's left of it? The Conservative Party? A new national party? We don't want any of this. We want it to be subsumed into something that overrides all of these parties. I think that has been said. Schismatism leads to not only the problems that we've encountered, it one time led to two popes, one in Rome and one in Avignon. So where do we go next? What we need is courage and forthrightness, which I believe Jez is going to talk about. We need to have the courage to stand up for what we believe in and be brave for our country. You call me a racialist? I don't call myself a racialist. I'm just doing what people naturally do and always have done. In Zululand and China and Singapore and Mongolia, and in Algeria, I'm putting my own people first and my own people's people first and loving them first. But that doesn't mean that I hate anybody else.
Yeah.
Racialism, I thought you chaps didn't like that word, but you are the ones to use it. I hadn't used it. That's the way we deal with these people. And we have the courage to speak up for what we believe in. And the louder we speak, and the more often, the more it gets ventilated, the more it will get spread. And what we, the nearer we get to what we're trying to achieve. The other comment I have, we've heard a lot today about political organisation and methods and what we have to do. And we've met some people who are very, very good organisers. Alex clearly is one, and obviously Julie is another. But is political effort, the effort we're going to have to put forth to save our country, is it a matter just of organisation? No, I think something else is required. Almost a religious approach. Something like the way in which Christianity suddenly spread across the world. I don't remember reading about candidates and agents and political campaigns and pamphlets. There may have been a pamphlet or two, for all I know. But it was a movement of the heart. And my God, if our hearts hadn't been moved by what's happened to our country... I've seen it all through my life, and I've fought, battled it in one way or another.
Well done.
Yeah. So let us place our task with something of the sense of a mission, not just a political initiative. Politics is going to save us. Politics has got us where we are now. It has to be something more. Don't ask me to name what it is now. I'm still thinking over what I've heard today, and I've only had a few minutes to put it together. I'll come back and tell you when I've decided. Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Right, I've nobody to introduce me, so I'll let, I think it's one of the Antifa groups, introduce me. They say that Jez Turner is one of the most influential fascists in Britain. Yes, one of. They say I'm the third most influential. Third. So who are the other two? Well, the second most influential is Paul Golding of Britain First. In his view, everything's due to Islam. The whole problems of the world is due to Islam. The first most influential is Tommy Robinson. Remember him?
Yeah.
EDL and Pegida. Again, everything's down to Islam.
Pro-Zionist.
Yes. And as far as I'm concerned, and people in this room today, those other two are Zionists. So they don't qualify. Which makes me not one of the most influential fascists in Britain, but the most influential fascist. Now, why do we need nationalists, activists and organisers? It's just common sense, isn't it? Just common sense, our ideology. We don't need to have all these names. In a sane world, everyone would agree with us. Now, I've forgotten my props. Hold this moment. We'll get some props here. I'm going to read a poem by a very famous man called J.R. Tolkien. And he tried to explain to us what was going on in the world. Read this poem. Some of you know this poem. Three rings for the elven kings under the sky. Seven for the dwarf lords in their halls of stone. Nine for mortal men doomed to die. One for the dark lord on his dark throne in the land of Mordor where the shadows lie. One ring to rule them all. One ring to find them. One ring to bring them all. And in the darkness bind them in the land of Mordor. Where the shadows lie. Now there is a war in this world today, a world war. It's a war between identity and globalization. A world of free, sovereign, independent nations fighting against a one world slave state. It's a war between honor against materialism, wisdom against brainwashing, philosophy against high finance, truth against lies, God against gold, life against death. And in this war, each person on this planet must choose which side he will fight on. So imagine a scene 50 years from now, perhaps 100 years from now. Grandad, what did you do in the great global war against globalism, the war that saved the white race from extinction?
Nothing.
Oh. Was that because you were a coward?
No. It's because I wanted to keep my job.
Why?
The little boy asked. Eternal question. Why? Why? Because I could continue to buy lots of things like Jim Gracks and Googles and rubbish.
Why?
So I could keep my status.
Why?
Because I didn't want to be called a racist, or anti-Semite, or a Nazi, or a fascist. Why? Because I didn't want the Jews to persecute me. Why? Oh, well, yes, it's because I was a coward. You win. But we in this room today are not cowards. Right? Just on the way this morning to Bristol, we're at Victoria Coach Station. We witnessed an innocent, beautiful, blonde French girl sitting there drinking a coffee, eating a croissant, and this villainous, ugly, evil-looking North African man sidled up to her, you know, began to chat her up, and I was just gobsmacked watching this. He looked like Abdul the Damned. You remember the black and white film, Abdul the Damned? And, you know, he was like three times her age, and he was showing her his money and all this sort of thing. And she just went, oh, yeah, do. She was putty in his hands. She had no defense mechanism. You know, and we just sat there shocked. And she was like a sleeping beauty at his mercy, you know. And this has been done to her designedly. Girls up and down this land, across Europe, across the world, have had their natural instincts taken away from them, and they've been brainwashed. And, you know, when we had to dash for our coat, so on the way past the little kiosk, we said to the person that over in the cafe there's a people trafficker there, human trafficker, go and sort him out. So hopefully that had an effect. But such scenes happen every day, in every town in this country. And the responsibility for this lies with those who control the mass media, those who control Hollywood, those who control our education system. And to all this brainwashing, our females are the most susceptible. Innocent victims to depravity. My friends, we cannot let this continue. It doesn't matter what group we're in, what faction, what particular ideology. We cannot let this continue. So we come to Bristol. Bristol, it is a strange irony of capricious fortune that the city that was once the maritime hub of the greatest empire the world has ever seen is now an ethnic minority slum where patriots are hunted and persecuted and must hire a room under a false name.
Yeah.
You know, Bristol, we've got the Clifton Suspension Bridge, we've got a wonderful museum, the cathedral, and the famous phrase, ship-shape and Bristol fashion, you know. And now we've got a slum, right? London, Bristol, England, Britain, we are now part of the Third World. Third World economically, socially, and ethnically. We just don't know it yet. We just haven't realised it yet. Britain is as corrupt and as bribe-ridden as any tin-pot African banana republic.
More so.
You
dress it up as law.
The corruption is just better hidden. Better hidden. And the press conspire to cover it up. No journalist ever gets imprisoned for loyally obeying the orders of his secret masters, as we've seen recently with the Sun. So how did this all happen? How did this change, all these horrible changes, come about? Well, I have an orderly mind, and I shall proceed in an orderly fashion. I used to be a librarian. For my sins, yes. All this change came about slowly. Happened very slowly. A slow submission, sinking from superior to second-class citizens, to servants, to slaves, to eventual extinction. It is a change about which you cannot ask a liberal, because liberals have no concept of time and no concept of history. They just live in the present, the immediate present. That's all there is. They're perfect materialists and consumers. Pleasure and leisure. Shopping malls and fornication. The frog is being boiled slowly. Very slowly. And it doesn't even realise it's being boiled. But why? Why did we let this deterioration happen? Well, it's been going on a long time. We've been under the control of the people who yearn for our destruction for a long, long time. The British Empire, after all, for all its good qualities, was nothing but an empire of the Rothschilds. And all these wars of empire wars, all these wars we fought, the Boer War, the First World War, were just a way for our secret rulers to kill the best and enslave the rest. Feminism, abortion, contraception, smaller families have killed off our best genes. And what we have left in the white world today are the dregs of a dying race. It is a strange thing to watch a race die. The money power controls every aspect of our miserable lives and tells us constantly that we are happy.
Celebrate.
We're told we are free. But without the approval of the money power, you can't hold a job. You can't get a job. You can't even have a bank account. You can't get those magic little tokens that our rulers give out to us called money. They use brainwashing, bribery, bullying, blackmail, and it's kept us quiet. It's kept us under control so far. Aristotle said the two characteristics of a dying race were cowardice and laziness. And you can see it among our people today, can't you? Most people, when they see the changes happening and the consequences of these changes, they sort of ignore it. They shut it out. They watch television. They're in denial. And then they sort of accept it and say, well, okay, yeah, perhaps it's not that bad after all. And they sort of perhaps even might oppose it in a very mild, lukewarm way. And then they say to themselves, well, it doesn't really matter anyway. What's race anyway? We're all, you know, featherless bipeds or something. And then they think, well, it's a good thing, really, you know. Diversity, vibrancy, enrichment, and all that rubbish, you know. You see, most people cannot take the truth. And all this is, of course, encouraged by the mass media. Now, The Economist. Oh, dear, The Economist, right. This picture here, last month's The Economist, has a picture of demonstrators, and they're shouting, migrants out! Build that wall! Smash globalism! Protect our jobs! Country first! And the headline is, why they are wrong. Now, if you read this learned article in The Economist, economics, yeah, they say, they're wrong, because what mass immigration does is that it means you can buy a cheap coffee in Starbucks in London. You can get a cheap woman to work in Starbucks, and you can go there and you can get a nice cheap coffee. Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that worth it all? Have you been to Starbucks? I hope not. Perhaps Cafe Nero, one of these other ones. You go there, you've got to queue up, right? And you get a cracked cup, and it's in like a soup bowl that cools in about 2 seconds, and the coffee tastes awful, and it costs you £3 or something. Now, forgive me for being a bit dim here, but I know a greasy spoon cafe, a good old-fashioned London greasy spoon cafe. I sit down, the waitress comes to me, very quick, cook up a coffee, no cracks, 50 pence. So what is their... This is The Economist, right? What a load of nonsense. What a load of absolute nonsense. But things are now beginning to change, because it's so obvious what's happening, right? It's so obvious that they can't hide it anymore. Immigration, mass immigration, the globalist power is destroying stuff. So here we have the National Geographic magazine. Very learned magazine. The new Europeans. So we've got some sort of Arab family. In here we've got Turks, we've got Africans, we've got Somalis, we've got Eritreans, Afghans, and all kinds of Africans, Asians, Orientals, and no Jews, that's right. But and it's all a good thing. It's all a good thing that they're changing our culture. Well, Hmm. You see, the assumption that these magazines take is that what is good for the Jews is good for us all. And what is bad for the Jews is bad for us all. In actual fact, the opposite is true. The inverse is true. You see, they live everywhere. They live among us. So what's good for them is actually bad for us, and vice versa. Another example of The Economist. This is this month's. Putinism. He's a villain. He's a devil. Why has he got little horns on there? He's got little jet fighters in his eyes, right? But what is Putin? He just says, no. What's good for the Russian people is good. And that's all you need to know. That's the sort of leader we need. Someone like that, right? Let's take some example of double standards and hypocrisy. Let's look at the current bombing campaigns in the Middle East, shall we? So we've got Mosul, right? Mosul is defended by rebels against fighter jets that are bombing and killing civilians. And when these civilians get killed, international press say, oh, these rebels are using civilians as a human shield. Isn't it dreadful? Isn't it dreadful? And a few hundred miles away, you've got Aleppo being defended by rebels and being bombed by fighter jets. You know, and civilians get killed and they say, oh, it's the fighter jets' fault for doing it. And you see the double standards there. You know, they blame the rebels in Mosul for killing, for human shields, using civilians as human shields, and then in Aleppo, it's all the fighter jets' fault. You know? And then there's Yemen. Yemen isn't even mentioned, right? American-backed Saudi jets, American-funded jets, American-owned jets, really. You know, Saudi's just a puppet of America, are bombing the Yemenis all day, but you never hear anything about it. And you never hear, of course, who's behind all these bombing campaigns in the Middle East, all this chaos, all this Arab Spring, all this anarchy. You never hear. Now, in Islam, in the Islamic world, you cannot say Muhammad without saying, peace be upon his name. And we laugh at that. We say, oh, so backwards, so, you know, oh, gosh, it's so narrow-minded. But, in the West, in America, try saying the word Jews without saying how wonderful, talented, caring, philanthropic, intelligent geniuses they all are. Try saying that and see what you get. And these groups like the EDL and Britain First, they criticise the Muslims for behaving like Muslims in Britain, in Europe, in America. But they never ask who brought the Muslims here. They never ask that question. And it needs to be asked. A lot of inexperienced people, naive people say, well, the Muslims hate the Jews. How can the Jews bring all these Muslims here and hope to rule the Middle East? You know, it doesn't make sense. Well, believe it or not, the Jews did a very good job of ruling the Ottoman Empire and ruling Islam in the past and in recent decades through hidden organizations, through convert sects, through financial influence. And believe it or not, Muslims used to say about Europe, the Jews will never rule Europe because the Christians would never consent to be controlled by Christ killers. Well, look at us now. Look at us now. Okay. Degeneration, decadence, deracination, decay everywhere. And liberals say this is progress. They say such changes are inevitable. They're happening everywhere. Well, it's rather like you're in a herd of cows and you're all going to the slaughterhouse. You say, look, we're all going to the slaughterhouse. We're all, it's natural, it's inevitable. We're all here, tromping along this lane to the slaughterhouse to be killed. It's what happens. But no, it just means all those cows, all that herd, is controlled by the same owner. The cows in another field, and the wild animals, they're not going to the slaughterhouse. It's just because we've got the same controls. The only thing inevitable is that if we do nothing, we will all be slaughtered. So how do we resist? Well, morale is the key. And meetings like this, networking, is very good for morale. Manfred Rohde used to say, When we sing, we will begin to win. We have among our ranks, of course, the do-nothing advocates, such critics within our movement who do nothing themselves except criticise those that do do things. They're basically doing the enemy's job for them. And in the end, they usually finally reveal their true colours by, and they usually reveal their true paymasters as well, by criticising anyone who criticises their true paymasters. And they end up criticising British nationalism, and they end up even criticising the white race and saying, well, it's a good thing if it was exterminated. We're no good anyway. But, my friends, doing nothing is not an option. Not speaking out is, as Mark Twain called it, the silent lie. Alexander de Tocqueville wrote about America. And he said two things can motivate any people over long periods of time. One is patriotism. The other is religion. Now, patriotism we all have. And believe it or not, we also have religion. Because anyone, anybody who believes in something higher than money has some sort of religious, spiritual belief. If you believe money is the god, you're their slave. You're the slave of money and who controls money. If you don't, then you've got a chance. And you people in this room today are your race's natural leaders because you have awareness of the problem. You see the solution. You see the answer. You have a conscience that nags at you that you must do something. You must do something. And you have the guts, the courage to actually go and do something. So I'm often asked, what motivates you? Are you a hater? Well, yes, I'm a hater. But I don't hate the puppet masters. They do what they do because that's in their nature. They do what's best for their own ethnic religious group. And they live among us, and that necessarily means it's not very good for us. No. When I say hate, I hate the puppets themselves.
Yeah.
The shallow, selfish, self-centred, short-sighted, self-serving, stupid puppets. I hate the race defilers. I hate the betrayers of our race, the traitors. And there is nothing more treacherous than to exterminate your own people and to be paid for it.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well done, dude.
My friends, one fine, glorious day, these traitors will get an all-expenses trip to the Tower of London and meet a traitor's death, and I will drink to that. Today. So what about love? I'm a lover, I admit it. I love women. I love culture. I love our values. I love our land. And I love our people. I love to see the faces of my people. The incredible joy and pride of a newly married couple. Well, not so newly married. With a newborn, firstborn baby. You know, I love to see that. I love to see the children playing in the street and dancing in a puddle in the sunshine after a summer storm. I love to hear the sound of children playing in the school grounds, you know. I love to see the thoughtful toddler as he examines his grandmother's hand and looks at it with consternation. I like to the feeling of cosy camaraderie going to a pub, you know. I like that. All this stuff is natural, it's healthy. It's called looking after your own. And to look after our own, we need borders, real borders. Effective borders. A house needs a door that locks, right? No borders, no order. It's etymology. Border, order. Look at Hispaniola. The island of Hispaniola. It's actually two countries. One country is called the Dominican Republic. It's lush, it's prosperous, its people are contented. If you take a plane and fly to America, you fly over that border, over that razor wire protected, military defended border. And suddenly, the land is deforested. Chaos reigns, poverty, violence, and you are in Haiti. And all that prevents that Dominican Republic being engulfed, being swamped, is an effective border. My friends, some things are worth fighting for.
Indeed.
Some things are worth dying for. Some things are worth killing for. Some things are worth doing anything for. We have a French speaker in the room here. Colonel Bastien Thierry, avec la raison. Do you remember that? He tried to kill President de Gaulle. De Gaulle was a traitor to France. And Bastien Thierry was immortalized and was put into a book form and film form. And you can read it. Day of the Jackal. A good film and a good book as well. Up until now, the truth of the matter is that despite the best efforts of people like J.R. Tolkien, most of our people did not realise the truth. The awful, horrible, despicable truth of what was happening to their world and why and who was behind it. We have a German speaker here. Schein der Gates, Wahrheit besteht. Appearance passes away, but truth remains. And in a sense, the reason our people never woke up, it's not surprising. They never saw a television program telling them the truth. They never heard a radio program. They never read a book or a film or newspaper. They never had any friends or teachers or professors or social workers who told them any different. They all were told the same tired old liberal dream. Socially Marxist, economically capitalist. And the professors who espoused this stance, who put forward this stance, they never used any evidence to back up their view, to justify their views. All they had was the power of their position, their authority, and rather like Samuel Butler's utopian fable, Erewhon, which means nowhere, anagram of nowhere, they relied on an unseen power with which they are in direct communication, right? Which tells them that they are right. Liberalism and Marxism are good things. They have this mysterious power that always tells them that. And we went along with it because we did not know any different. And that's all changing now. It's all changing now because we have a secret weapon. Not so secret weapon. The internet. With the internet and the plain ridiculousness of the society we're heading into, the plain obviousness of what's happening, where common sense is being outraged repeatedly again and again, and the pain it's causing, people are beginning to realise that liberal dream is actually a nightmare. The wogs begin at Calais, do they not? We look across the channel and we see smoke. We see what looks like a battle at D-Day. It's a war zone over there, and the jungle is burning. And they send us their so-called children. Do you know, 16-year-old children in Britain go to fight in the British Army, right? And they say these children in the Calais, they have relatives here. My God, these children have relatives everywhere. Right? Oh, they have a brother in Birmingham. Yeah, but their mother and father's in Afghanistan. Why don't they go back there? You know? And now we're letting in anyone without relatives. Just under 18, come along. You look at under 20, what I'd be doing. Come on, anyone. Just come in, and we'll put you in foster care in Hammersmith. What about the right to live in Hammersmith? This is a green light for the whole world to send us their teenagers. They have a good life here. They'll get a free council house. All the benefits. A nice cash sum every week for doing sweet nothing. Right? They can spend their whole day chatting up girls in Victoria Coach Station. Or we have to work. Lily Allen. Lily Allen. Compassionate, yeah? Compassionate. It's a selective compassion, isn't it? Let's face it. What about our children who are suffering? What about Rotherham? And every town up and down this country has a Rotherham. Every village even. And the press say, our wonderful free media say, we should take more immigrants. We can do it. We just need to build more houses, more schools, more health centres, more towns, just building a few parks, you know, concrete over a few green belts. In fact, turn the UK into like a Hong Kong, basically. But who's going to pay for all this? Who's going to suffer? You. And people like you. You'll pay for it. You'll suffer. Not Eddie Izzard, not Bob Geldof, not Lily Allen. They won't suffer. Mm. You may as well say, yes, we can take and should take more immigrants. We just need a bigger country, a bigger nation. Then we can take them all. For a nation is a ship. And just like the ships and boats that used to come to Bristol, there's a problem with the ship. Now, the priority job of an oarsman on a lifeboat is to row the lifeboat away from the sinking ship. But he has a second very important job. He uses that oar when he's rowing. And all around in the water are survivors. And they want to get on that lifeboat. And his job, his orders, are if somebody puts their hand on the lifeboat gunwale, he's to whack it with the oar and break their knuckles. He's to do anything he can to stop those survivors getting in the lifeboat. Because that lifeboat is full. And if one more person gets on that lifeboat, then that lifeboat sinks and everyone dies. My friends, this country is full. So thanks to the internet, thanks to reality, liberals are beginning to understand that something is wrong. They know that for Western society, things are going to get a lot, lot worse. A lot, lot tougher, a lot, lot more vicious, a lot harsher, a lot worse. There's one liberal intellectual, travel writer, name of Ben Judah. And he wrote a book called This Is London. Very good book, actually. Very good book. And it paints a very dark, dismal picture. In this book, people come to London. They arrive, many of them at Victoria Coach Station, and they think the streets are paved with gold, and they come here to better themselves. And many of them are actually work very hard. But you know, if you worked hard for the next 400 years, you couldn't afford a deposit on a flat in London. And they're miserable. There is not one single success story in this book. It's all about immigrants. The multiracial mess that London has become. Whites are the minority, right? This is going to happen in every town, city in this country, right? The only success story is a Nigerian illegal immigrant without the right papers who was given a job as a policeman. Metropolitan Police. Imagine that. A legal immigrant got a job as a policeman. And some white boy didn't because of that. So I went to the book launch of this book. And after Mr. Ben Judah had given his spiel about please buy that Bama book, you know, I asked a question. Rather like here, there's an audience speaker. And I said, Mr. Judah, your book is a very brave book. And I commend you for it. You have mentioned various ethnic groups. You've mentioned Asians, you've mentioned Muslims, Africans, East Europeans, but you haven't mentioned a certain group. You haven't mentioned Stamford Hill, Golders Green, and the Shoam Rim vigilantes who go around vigilanteing non-Jews, shall we say. Now, as a Jew, you were able to say things that non-Jews are too scared to say. So what would you say to the view that these changes in London and in our nation at large and in Europe at large and in the USA, this change in London and the UK, this immigration, this multiracialism, this multiculturalism is largely the result of Jewish influence in politics, academia and the mass media? One lady walked out rather quickly. And he went, oh dear. He went, oh. Well, political policy and immigration policy is largely a result of government ministers. And if we look over the past 60 years, not many have been Jews. So he said, well, remember Margaret Thatcher's cabinet? More old Estonians than old Etonians. Nevertheless, a very brave chap. Charles Clover's written a book, White Wind, Black Snow, all about Putin's Russia, and all about Russian nationalism. See, what's not mentioned very often is that Putin is actually quite a moderate in Russian terms. And if Putin falls, there are nationalists far to the right of Putin. Rather like someone in this room today, who will step into the void and seize and take power. Peter Frankopan wrote the book The Silk Road. And he has said that people are coming to the view now that liberalism, this holy sacrosanct liberalism, is just another ideology. Kwasi Kwarteng,
yes.
African MP for Heathrow West, I believe. Right? He said in a recent article somewhere, he said that political correctness and liberalism can only be afforded by wealthy countries. Poor countries can't afford all that rubbish. They just hang people from a banyan tree and get done with it. They can't even afford prisons. Political correctness and liberalism cannot be afforded by countries who are no longer rich. Only rich countries can afford it. And Britain is no longer rich. Now, I started with Tolkien. Tolkien was part of a group called the Inklings, which included C.S. Lewis, who wrote the Tales of Narnia, but also included a chap called Charles Williams, who wrote a book called Shadows of Ecstasy, 1931. An interesting book, this, because in it, there's an uprising of the non-white races in the world, and it's all stage-managed, financed, and funded by a group of people in Britain, using money from certain sources. Jews, okay. Not all Jews, you know, but they use Jewish money. And there's an invasion of Britain by Africans. And they're rioting in Hampstead and celebrating. And the invasion force is repelled, expelled, and Britain is saved by a few good, brave men. A few brave patriots. Well, it's time once more that a few good men came to save the day. As I said, the Third World War really has already begun. It's globalism versus identity. It's the unseen power versus the ideology of common sense. It's evil versus good. And there comes a time in the life of every person to choose a side. And all morality and duty compels us to do whatever we can to help in this struggle. And we now have a chance to save that little blonde French girl and people like her. Because the situation is becoming obvious. The global elite is destroying us all. And this is obvious. If you believe in freedom, they will destroy you. If you believe in nations, they will destroy you. If you believe in borders, they will destroy you. If you believe in traditional values, they will destroy you. And this is all becoming clear. Donald Trump knows it. Marine Le Pen knows it. Norbert Hofer knows it. Vladimir Putin knows it. Even President Duterte of the Philippines knows it. Marxism, liberalism, feminism, and all the rest of the ridiculous, politically correct nonsense has merely been a blip, a dangerous blip, but a blip in the course of history. And it's now time for the ideology of common sense to assert itself and push them all into the gutter where they so truly belong. It's now or never, it's do or die. And there are many ways to fight the good fight. In France, you have the Front National fighting elections, you have the GUD on the streets with demonstrations, kicking up a fuss and getting headlines and drawing press inches. You have nationalist magazines. In a sense, a nationalist magazine attached to the party, like Spearhead, has always been metapolitical. It's not just subscribers and readers who read it. And these meetings are like a nationalist magazine, like Vanguard, like Lionheart, like Nationalism Today, like Spearhead. All these three things, metapolitics, politics, and street activity, play a vital role. You must find the way that you enjoy the best, the way that you are most effective, and you must fight now. And I'll quote some Macbeth here to you. Here upon this bark and shoal of time, this bank and shoal of time, we must fight or succumb to extinction. We must fight or be like cowards in our own esteem. He who loves his people loves them in his heart. And in his heart, the courage makes that love known. This is no time for cowardice. If we should fail, it is the end of everything, the be-all and end-all. But, if we screw our courage to the sticking place, we'll not fail. So, let us lead our people. Let us fight. Let us win. And let us make Britain great again. Thank you very much.
System. Be tuned to the Pro White System. RadioArian.com.